You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXE Truxton.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go...
Take public comment. We've got a few people signed up. Because we've got such a heavy schedule, we'll limit it to 2 minutes today. The first name signed up is George. Can't read the second name. Hickey or Hickney? Go ahead.
Thank you.
2 minute limit, please.
Okay. I'm looking at the WTO after action report recommendations, and I'd just like to begin with reading a comment from the SPD. The SPD has concluded that both tear gas and pepper spray are widely regarded as safe demonstration management tools when used appropriately by law enforcement personnel. Well, my personal testimony is that the SPD does not use pepper spray appropriately. I was assaulted by pepper spray by an Officer White under the direction of Lieutenant Took, both of the police department, Seattle Police Department. During the WTO in 1999, the city recently settled with me for a substantial amount of money. Neither of the officers that were involved in assaulting me have received any retraining, any disciplinary action, any incentive not to do it again. None of the police officers on the Seattle Police Department witnessing the behavior that they have gotten away with are under any incentive not to do it again. I can testify personally that that stuff hurts a lot. I was completely blinded for a good period of time. I feared for my sight. I was in intense pain. And the thing is, I was violating no law. I was wearing Seattle Police Department issued credentials, assuming any Seattle police officer should be able to observe those credentials and recognize them for what they were. After spraying me in the face, Officer White chased me into the crowd as I fled him and sprayed me in the back of the head. Now, he was clearing the sidewalk for emergency vehicles, according to his testimony. I was the only one leaving. He's spraying me in the back of the head, and he's spraying nobody that was staying. My contention is that he was spraying me for the simple reason that I was taking photographs of his behavior as he hosed down nonviolent, non-threatening young protesters who were sitting in the street committing acts of civil disobedience with the intention of being arrested and hauled peacefully away. The pepper spraying, the assault on these guys, on these demonstrators, and on myself was unnecessary and cowardly and dangerous for everybody's health involved. Thank you.
Thank you. Mark Taylor Canfield.
Hi, I'm Mark Taylor Canfield. I'm with the Committee for Government Accountability. We're a group that sat in on the WTO investigations by the city for about 9 months last year. And there are many issues that have not been dealt with in this report. And from the point of view of the committee, I'd like to protest that fact. There are so many things that it will take another report just to respond. But I can list a few here quickly. There are some issues regarding N30, the WTO protests, and the recent Asia-Pacific Cities Summit. And this regards the seeming police policy of creating no protest zones. We saw that during the WTO, which has resulted in a major civil lawsuit against the city by the ACLU for constitutional rights violations. We saw it during N30 when downtown was cordoned off for about four blocks and no one was allowed to enter or leave as officers prepared for military-style arrests. And you also had officers moving into legal marches during the Asia-Pacific City Summit and arresting people for seemingly no reason at all, which basically caused a lot of fear in the crowd. So the march was stopped at that point by those kinds of actions. So we object to that, and we don't think that that's being addressed in the recommendations. We also are very concerned about the legislative reforms that were brought forward after the original WTO investigation. There were a list of legislative reforms that my committee suggested and that we were working with Peter Steinbrück on. We don't know what happened to those, but we do know that we were able to help push through a police ID ordinance, which we have many reports of police still violating. We also have an Amnesty International report to the UN Committee on Torture about conditions inside the King County Jail. We have a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling which says that The use of pepper spray at point-blank range on nonviolent protesters is tantamount to torture. And we have continued legal settlements being paid out by the city. We had $11 million that it cost the city. We've got very critical reports by my committee, the National Lawyers Guild, the Trial Lawyers for Public Justice, who are now having a major class action lawsuit against the city for constitutional rights violations. We don't think that these issues of lack of due process, we don't think that the OPA is truly independent, and we think that the perception that police officers are unaccountable for their actions is something that we must change immediately. Thank you.
What you just heard was an excerpt from public comment in response to the release of a report on the actions of the police during the 1999 protests against the World Trade Organization in Seattle. Commissions of inquiry in the wake of incidents of so-called civil unrest have become routine. Whatever their recommendations and findings, some basic assumptions are never addressed by such commissions. While they normally criticize the handling of the situation by police, they always stop short of questioning why it is that whenever citizens take to the streets to demand a change in public policy, they are met with phalanxes of police. Who are the police protecting? Who do the police actually work for? There's ample freedom and democracy available in society for those with money. Those with money may hire lawyers to press their causes. Those with money may purchase media outlets through which their views are disseminated. Those with money may donate lavishly to get candidates elected who will serve their interests. When those without money use the means at their disposal to gain redress, they are commonly met with police and prison, and in an ominous development, are being labeled as terrorists as soon as they mount significant resistance to the status quo. One group that is fighting to win is the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, OCAP. OCAP hasn't beaten, gassed, or shot anyone. Instead, they are mobilizing a broadening constituency throughout the province of Ontario with the goal of bringing down the regime of Premier Mike Harris. Tonight, we'll focus on their ideas, analysis, and the response of the Canadian authorities to their campaign of economic disruption. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary.
The Rangers and deputies are hired by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shiny black bears.
Before we get into the main body of the program tonight, I'd like to address some correspondence we received in response to our program 2 weeks ago about farm workers' efforts to change the laws governing their working conditions. We were contacted by Chris Pawelski, an onion farmer in Goshen, New York, who has been a public spokesperson of farmers opposing the legislation. We're not sure how Mr. Pawelski learned of our program, as Goshen is located about 50 miles from New York City, well out of our broadcast range. Nor do we know if he's going to hear this response. Mr. Pawelski said our broadcast was unfair to farmers because it did not present the views of those opposed to the legislation. Mr. Pawelski sent written material detailing his objections to the legislation and expressed the view that farm workers are treated fairly. Ultimately, the substance of his objections are that complying with the legislation is a financial hardship and that allowing farm workers to form unions gives them an unfair advantage that could put him out of business in the case of a strike. These arguments are not unique to Mr. Pawelski. They are the arguments always put forward by employers when their workers seek better pay and working conditions through collective bargaining. Mr. Pawelski describes himself as a family farmer. He and his wife own a 5,000-acre onion farm. This is quite a large family farm, though it is on the small side as factory farms go when compared to some of the 50,000-acre establishments in the Midwest and California. To give Mr. Pawelski the benefit of the doubt, he's in the difficult position of being not quite big enough nor quite small enough. Fruits and vegetables require far more handwork than grains. Some of the producers of this program have family members who are farmers and farm workers. Most family farms, however, are nowhere near the size of Mr. Pawelski's spread. Most family farms grow more than one crop or also include livestock. The family farmers we know, organic farmers, hire local people when they need extra help and pay them $8 to $10 an hour, far better wages than Wegmans or Staples, for example. They don't employ more than 11 workers and as a result are excluded from the provisions of the legislation. Farm worker legislation has been geared to large corporate farms who employ seasonal immigrant workers. The reason that these farms employ immigrant workers instead of local people is because they can pay these workers a low wage and treat them poorly in a way that no citizen would put up with. Let's face it, these immigrant workers have mostly dark skin and mostly don't speak English, and sadly, this justifies their poor treatment in the minds of some. These attitudes make factory farms no different than any other sweatshop. Now, we're not suggesting that Mr. Pawelski holds these views. In fact, he seemed particularly to want to emphasize that he didn't treat his farm workers like slaves. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt that he is a hard-working farmer with decent motivations struggling to keep his head above water. This brings us to the real issue, one that can't ultimately be solved by legislation. In last week's program, the small farmers whose voices we heard repeatedly mentioned the fact that they were required to sell their produce below the cost of production, and that while plenty of money was being made in the food industry, it was not being made by the people who grow the food. This situation is a perfect example of the failure of the market economy. Since growing food is fundamental and necessary to sustain life, an economic system that favors the production of car deodorizers over food is seriously flawed, to say the least. Market capitalism developed with the Industrial Revolution. It's based on cheaply extracting labor and resources and pocketing the value added by the manufacturing process as profit by selling the product. Therefore, it is hardly surprising that, as farming, a pre-capitalist activity, has been shoehorned into this economic model, it is the people who sell and distribute the product rather than those who produce the product that are getting the lion's share of the money.
Well, money has its own way, and money has to grow. It grows on human blood and bone, as any child would know. It's iron stuff and paper stuff, with no life of its own. And so it takes its growing sap from human blood and bone. And many a child goes hungering because the wage is low, and men die on the battlefield to make the money grow. And those that take the money crop are avid without end. They plant it in the tenements to make it grow again.
Canada has historically had a better social safety net than the United States. In recent years, as a result of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, the U.S. has increasingly begun to dominate the Canadian economy. Along with economic integration, Canadian politicians have been following their American counterparts in dismantling the social welfare system. The Premier of the Province of Ontario, Mike Harris of the Tory Party, is an enthusiastic free marketer. His policies have caused massive social dislocation and an increase in extreme poverty similar to that found in the United States. On June 12th, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty staged an eviction at the office of the provincial finance minister. In retaliation for the several thousand evictions that are taking place each month in Toronto since the Harris government abolished rent control, 19 people were arrested, and one, Sean Lee Popham, is still in jail. Stuart Duncan of CFRU-FM spoke with him from the Whitby jail on July 9th.
So we're speaking with Sean Lee Popham, a member of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, who is currently in Whitby jail related to charges brought forth from OCAP's recent eviction of Ontario Finance Minister Jim Flaherty. Sean, thank you for being with us.
No problem, Stuart.
Could you guys give us a background of the action in Whitby and, I guess, the police harassment that yourself and other OCAP members have experienced following it?
For sure. OCAP is part of the upcoming fall Defeat Harris campaign. Took on an action on June 12th to evict Jim Flaherty from his constituency office. Flaherty, for those who don't know, was once the Attorney General of Ontario who brought in the Safe Streets Act, which has basically criminalized squeegeeing and banned lots of forms of panhandling in Toronto and generally made it harder and harder for poor people and homeless people to survive in Toronto and made Toronto a friendlier city for tourism and business.
Mm-hmm.
And most recently as the finance minister, and he brought in the bill in which private school funding was capable under the new provincial government. So we decided that there aren't that many options left for people. There's over 2,000 evictions a month in Toronto alone. Now that rent control is gone, it's in fact in the landlord's interest to evict people so that they can now raise the rent by whatever amount they choose to once they can get the current tenants out. So a group of people from Toronto went up to Whitby and did an eviction of his office, basically took the furniture out of the office. In the process of the action, there was 12 arrests there. And then since the action, there's been 7 more, bringing the total up to 19 arrests from the action.
Could you provide details of your latest bail hearings or of other OCAP members, and maybe, I guess, some of the details of your future legal challenges related to the Flaherty eviction that, I guess, you yourself might face?
For sure. There was, as I said, 19 in total arrested. 4 of us were held in jail, weren't released on bail immediately. 2 of us, Omid Zarian and Arita Withers, received bail late, approximately about 2 weeks ago. I received a detention order, as did John Clark. They brought up in our original bail hearing, they had detectives from the Toronto Police Service who went on about different information. If it wasn't the fact that we were being held in jail, it would have been a little bit funny. They had the Defeat Harris posters, which people may have seen around, but if you haven't, mm-hmm. they're a large Defeat Harris at the top in red, red background with black writing, and it says Fight to Win at the bottom. And so they were talking about how the red and black coloring are showing the anarchist overtones that OCAP uses, and Fight to Win, once again, a rallying cry of OCAP, and how this is a militant terrorist group, and how we operate in small cells, and sort of things like this, just trying to paint us in a very terrorist sort of color.
Mm-hmm.
So both of us were DO'd, which means we had a detention order put out on us, and we were denied bail. John Clark went up for bail review yesterday, and we're very excited to hear that he was released yesterday. The judge came down very harshly against the JP and the Crown in the previous case, said that justice hadn't been carried out, that really John clearly didn't pose a threat to society. There was no reason that he shouldn't be released. And if the paperwork goes well, hopefully I'll have a bail review next Monday. So John, even if I do have a review next Monday and I'm released, I will have been in for 36 days, I think.
Mm-hmm. An amazing amount of time.
By then, for not really that many charges.
Do you believe, I guess, some of the amount of police and government repression that OCAP members are receiving is a tactic to stop the strengthened movement opposing the Mike Harris Tories and their devastating policies that is being seen, I guess, with many, many groups uniting behind the call for the campaign of economic disruption this fall?
Yeah, well, I think very clearly from the conditions imposed on the members of non-association, of not being allowed to attend any OCAP events. Sue Collis, one of the organizers for OCAP, was released was arrested and later released on bail after the Flaherty action, and one of her conditions was that she could associate with OCAP for only work-related purposes. Now, after the June 15th mass public meeting in Toronto, she was going home and about to get on the subway, and the police arrested her there because they said she was breaching her non-association condition. She was held from Friday, came up on Monday, where they made allegations that OCAP was in fact an illegal organization, and she was held over for a whole another week until she was released. So it was very clear that they were trying to make an example of OCAP. And I think for a while we were unclear how the left movement was going to take it. But in the last few weeks, it's been very, very clear that people across the province are really coming to the support of OCAP. We had a press conference last Friday, and the CLC was there demanding the release of people still in jail and voicing their support. Since the Flaherty action, we've had 200 new organizations sign on to the fall campaign. Organizations like the OSSTF, the Toronto Region, Secondary Schools Teachers Federation. This is a not normally known as a radical union, has signed on to support the economic disruption campaign. There was a large meeting of the Grand Chiefs of Ontario on Walpole Island last weekend, and they all came out in support of it. Charles Fox, who's the Grand Chief of Ontario, was calling that they were going to support the fall action, and we were going to see more OCAs in Epawash and Gustafson Lakes in Ontario this coming fall. So I think it's been really clear from the support that we've received that people are willing to support these sorts of actions, and people are willing to get behind the economic disruption campaign.
I guess the massive numbers of arrests that we've seen from oppositions around Canada, such as what happened at the Summit of the Americas in Quebec City and the recent arrests of OCAP members after the Flaherty eviction, and even the June 15th action of last year, the march to Queen's Park, are those a sign of a political movement that is becoming more of a threat to these systems of exploitation and oppression, be it, I guess, capitalism, neoliberalism, or, I guess, corporate governmental power?
I think it's something that we need to expect as long as we stand on the sidelines and write petitions and have candlelight vigils and polite rallies. And if that's all we do, then the government in power is willing to smile and nod and let us go about that. But as soon as it becomes clear that we actually can mobilize and organize a threat against these policies, be them globalization policies that are happening at the Summit of the Americas, or be them the globalization policies taking place right in our own backyard here in Ontario with laws such as the Safe Street Act, with cutting back welfare 23%, with the Employment Standards Act, which legalizes the 60-hour work week. And it's clear that if we are able and going to challenge these sort of laws and these sort of policies, then these are the consequences that people are going to face. We are going to experience more repression from the state.
Mm-hmm. I guess although
it's unfortunate, I think it is a sign of being effective.
Mm-hmm. Could you give a background on the conditions in Whitby Jail?
For sure. We had, in fact, the day we came in, there was actually a riot here in the jail. One of the rangers rioted over pulling of their privileges of using the phone and watching TV. Since I've been in for 4 or 5 weeks now. There was the riot here in Whitby. There was a hunger strike and a riot in Maplehurst. And there was a hostage taking and a riot in Fort Francis, which is a jail up near Thunder Bay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very clear that the situations in jail are really volatile. There's other people here who have been here longer than me that could probably speak to that better, and I can pass you on to them now if you want to.
Okay, yep, you can do that.
Hello?
Hi there.
Hi.
I was wondering, I guess, if you can give us a little background about maybe, I guess, some of the conditions in the Whitby Jail and what life is like there and in the environment of the Whitby Jail.
Well, the medical part of it is the biggest problem for the inmates because the meds are they're given out so irregular. You know, and there's some, like, diabetics in here that they only get their medicine maybe 11 o'clock in the morning, and they should be getting it at 8. They get it twice a day when they're supposed to get it 3 times a day. I mean, like myself, I'm on medication, and I should have it 3 times a day, and I get it once, and I get sleeping medication at 5 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not right because they don't want to pay a nurse or the captain to deliver it, you know, at 8 o'clock. And it's and a lot of the inmates that are on medical, I guess the medical is the worst part.
Mm-hmm.
And the overcrowding in the cells.
Yeah, we've heard various accounts throughout the province of Ontario of the devastating conditions in prisons throughout this province. As I guess Ontario is poor and homeless, and I guess exploited in general, or being housed in very disastrous conditions. I wonder if can you give us, like you mentioned, I guess some of the issues of overcrowding. Is that something that
it happens all the time, and there's no need of it. Like there's 2 empty ranges upstairs that can be used during the week, and on the weekends they crowd 15 to 20 guys into a 10 guy range when there's an empty range right behind them, and during the week it sits empty and there's still guys sleeping on the floor, and it's not sanitary.
Mm-hmm.
And just causes the guys are all emotional because they're so close, you know, and there's no room to do anything. You're eating in your cell and there's just no room, and it puts everybody on edge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can understand what it's like. I know it's tough to understand, but it's just not good for the inmates.
Mm-hmm.
They're here to be rehabilitated, not to be... they're just shut off from the outside and
mm-hmm.
treated as if they're just nothing.
Yeah, constantly exploited.
Yeah, it's not right, I don't feel.
I guess, can you maybe give a background of what your relationship has been with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty members, and perhaps are you going to maybe link your struggle of like the devastating conditions in the Whitby Jail with some of the work that the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty is doing with the against the Ontario government here in Ontario?
Well, the Ontario government, they've done so many cutbacks that in the jails, that's their biggest complaint here is the cutbacks. And I've some of the people that I've met from OCAP now, they're just normal people trying to make it good for people like myself that have nobody else to speak out for us.
Mm-hmm.
And they just seem to be doing the job that we need to be somebody out there doing to make things better for the ones inside. Because nobody in, like, the Whitby Jail and that is really, they have to be rehabilitated, like I say, but they have to be treated like a human being as well.
What has your relationship been with, I guess, the prison staff there? How has your treatment been by those staff?
Most of the Whitby staff has been pretty good. You have your odd one that treats you as if you're not a person, but the other ones, they give you the respect that you need, and you give it back.
I guess, did you have any, comments you'd like to say to our listeners tonight?
If more people stick together, the Harris government isn't going to be able to make all the cuts that they've been making to all the systems, including the health care. Somebody has to stand up, and OCAP's doing what we all want to do,
mm-hmm.
but we're just all too scared to do, I guess, fight the government.
Taking a confrontational approach.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you a lot for your time tonight. I guess, is Sean still there?
Yep, Sean's right here.
Okay, thank you a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Hello.
Another question here is, what can listeners on the outside do to support yourself, OCAP, and all the prisoners, I guess, of conscious in our prison system? As, I guess, people are kind of on the outside looking in, what can we do to maybe work against the devastating effects in our prisons and also kind of link that with our day-to-day struggles?
I think the linking it to the day-to-day struggles is the important part to do. First of all, people can get to know people who are in prison, find out where the prisons are in your community. For example, in Guelph, you've got a correctional center and a detention center right there. So get in touch with people on the inside, find out ways to get inside, either through volunteering, doing books to prisoners, setting up prisoner pen pal systems, but also finding out people who have family or friends in jail. How do they get to visit their prisoners? Can
could they do with a, if there was a shuttle bus going once a week from downtown Guelph to the prison, would families be able to take advantage of that? As far as how you can support the OCAP prisoners who are in, really, for me, what's the best form of support for me is knowing that there's people out there continuing to organize in their communities, continuing to build a movement that can challenge and replace this government, a movement that has a long-term vision and that's rooted right where you are. So whatever that means, if that means continuing the work that people are doing already, that's great. People can get involved in the fall campaign, and that's just finding out what's happening in Guelph and taking the struggle to where we live instead of going to different towns to do it there. I guess there'll also be, there are financial costs to this of getting bail together, the costs of our canteen and long-distance phone calls and legal costs. So if people want to make a contribution in any way, that would, of course, be appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
And they can send that to, should I give the address now? Or
if you can, yeah.
To OCAP, care of, to Legal Defense, care of OCAP. And the address is 249 Sherbourne Street, Toronto, Ontario, M5A2R9. And if there's people listening and they don't know what's going on in their town for the fall and they want to get involved, they could email OCAP at OCAP, O-C-A-P, at DAO, T-A-O, dot C-A. And we can hopefully get you plugged in whatever way.
How do you believe, I guess, the prison system then, the police forces and the courts work to, I guess, silence dissent in this province and around the world?
Sorry, you'll have to... I couldn't quite hear you.
How do you believe the prison system, I guess, the police forces and the courts work to silence dissent as we're seeing, I guess, the unprecedented amount of police repression against OCAP, against activists in general? How do you believe that they work together to silence people who dissent the devastating policies of the Mike Harris government and other, I guess, similar policies?
I think in Canada, we're just starting to see the first people who are being refused bail. For example, the German L5 and Jaggi Singh in Quebec, and there's the people in with OCAP from the Flaherty Action who are refused bail. And within the next year, we'll see the first people who are actually convicted and put away for 6 months or a year or 2 years or more from politically related charges. So I think at this point, really the way that the courts serve to silence people isn't so much yet within the political movement, but just the way that the courts and the prisons and the general injustice system acts to silence the poorest part of the population. Being in jail, you really are forced to recognize that jails are storage houses for the poor. People who have money don't go to jail. They can afford bail. They have friends who can put up sureties. They own houses. They can afford expensive lawyers. They just don't end up here. They're also not forced to commit the same sorts of crime that people don't who don't have money are forced to commit. If you don't have money, you're going to get it somewhere. And if that means stealing, if that means selling drugs, you're going to get by some way. You have a family to feed. You have people you love. You want to take care of them. I've seen endless people come in and just day after day after day go to court. And they've been offered bail. They've been offered... There was this one man who was offered $1,000 bail, and he went to court 11 days in a row. And he couldn't get out because he didn't have anyone in his family who could come and post the $1,000. Either they had to work, they had to take care of the kids. If they left their work, they'd lose their job. Here he is, he's inside, he's going to lose his job because he can't get out. It's just a vicious cycle. So I think at this point, really the way that the courts and the justice system work is they work in general against the have-nots. of society, and they work his way. People in here, you're not given any chance to exceed. It's just a huge waste of human potential. And you're basically told by the corpse and by the cost that you're disposable, and you're thrown in here.
You were arrested on charges related to OCAP's march to Queen's Park last summer. How do you believe treatment of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty and other activists throughout Ontario has changed since that event?
How have the actions changed since then?
Basically, how do you believe the treatment of OCAP by, like, governmental forces, by police forces, how has that changed since the action last summer at Queen's Park?
I think we've seen an increased police presence at everything OCAP does, but that's not independent. We've seen an increased police presence at everything since last June, when the finance ministers from the
FTA countries,
to begin the negotiations of the
The Free Trade Area of the Americas.
There's this background noise in our canteen has just arrived. It's very exciting. It's our one chance at junk food for the week. Where was it? Oh, yeah. When the finance ministers met from all the countries of America in November 99 in Toronto, there was no police presence. And now, 2 years later, when they meet in Quebec City, we see a huge police presence. And I think we've seen that all over. So the OCAP has experienced a lot of it. I think that's universal throughout the movement on the left in Ontario and probably throughout North America.
I guess in the face of the massive levels of police harassment, what motivates yourself and the other OCAP members to continue the vital work that you do?
If there was an option, I wouldn't be in jail. I don't see what else we can do. People are dying on the streets. I've spent nights walking around with friends trying to find appropriate bank machines for them to sleep in. I have friends who can't live in Toronto because of the air quality. You got friends who are dying because of where they live. You got cops coming around the corner at Dundas and Sherbourne with their guns out. Just sitting here watching the news every night, and it's all about the Olympics and just people being, it's just the hugest propaganda war I've ever seen of every day. 8 minutes at the start of news on the Olympics. There's never 8 minutes on the start of news about anything. And if we think things are bad now, if Toronto gets the Olympics, we're going to see 8 years of increased crackdown on the poor and increased ghettoization. And we've tried everything. There's been the days of action against Harris. We had, 750,000 people in Toronto, on the streets of Toronto, and shut down the city for 2 days. And they smiled and laughed and went back to their normal everyday Harris policies. So I think for people who have the privilege and have the choice of confronting the government, it's a responsibility.
I was wondering if you could give a background about, I guess, that we've been talking about the economic disruption campaign in the fall. I guess maybe give a background of the campaign, what's already been, some of the plans that are underway already, and maybe some of the links with the other communities of resistance throughout the province of Ontario that have already happened.
For sure. After June 15th of last year, after the march on Queen's Park, people in OCAP sat down and tried to figure out what really needed to be done. The idea of fight to win, the idea that if we're going to be involved in a struggle, we want to be involved in one that's effective, one that gets something done. And so if we want to either hold this government accountable or replace this government, what is it that needs to happen? And we realize that this isn't something that OCAP or any group can do alone. This needs to be a huge province-wide movement. So the idea of a of an economic disruption campaign came out, and this was one where in communities across the province in which they wanted to defeat Harris, there would be a time chosen in the fall where whatever actions people in these communities felt was appropriate would be taken. On June 16th, there was a general assembly where delegates from all around the province came to discuss plans for the fall. Fortunately, I wasn't able to be there because I was here in jail, but from what I've heard, I'm going to go up because I actually signed for my canteen, and if I don't go, I don't get it all. Come right back, and there's a man here who wanted to tell you a little bit about his story, if that's okay.
Okay.
Hello, Stuart?
Yes.
My name's Dennis Edwards.
Hi.
And I've been charged with 5 breaches and 1 criminal harassment.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been to court 11 times for bail, and I'm going for the 12th. And I have no violence on my record, and I'm 54 years old, and I've been red flagged by the Durham police, and they say I carry a gun, and I don't. I've never owned a gun. They say I'm violent and vicious, and I have no criminal record of any assaults or gun carrying or anything, and they're denying me bail.
I guess, can you maybe give a background to the people outside? Like, what is...
Pardon?
Like, can you give maybe a background on some of the conditions inside the Whitby jail, and also...
Well, what it's like inside the jail?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's pretty dirty.
Mm-hmm.
They don't fix anything. Like, they're going to be tearing it down. The taps don't work. You can flood the toilets easy by just by pressing 4 or 5 toilets at the same time. They sleep like I've slept in a cell meant for one that had 4 people in it. They just warehouse people. I was trying to get into the Oshawa Hospital,
mm-hmm.
and I was there for 5 days, and then I got out. And I went back on the weekend and tried to get in again. And within 36 hours, I was arrested. But there's always room in the Whitby jail for somebody, but there's no room for social medical help, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And on the outside. They'll warehouse you in the jail. They'll just stuff you in, like, sleep you down in the entryways or whatever. Like, when you have a holding cell.
Mm-hmm.
They've had, there's no bigger than, I'd say, 5 by 8, and they've had 3 or 4 people sleep there overnight. And like the jail is just disgustingly dirty. And I never was in jail up until I was 50 years old, and I'm 54 now. And it is disgusting. And there's nothing to do here.
Do you believe that you're being, I guess, targeted for this type of harassment because, I guess, of your place in society you fall out of, I guess...
Pardon?
Do you believe you're being... are constantly harassed in the jail system by the police because of part of, I guess, your place in society, how always it seems to be the jails.
Once they get a hold of it, they won't let you go.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm on some such ridiculous charges right now that they're just so ridiculous. Like, overzealous police, as a lawyer called it, okay? Once they get your name, you are targeted.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it this way. I had a fender bender this January, and there was no damage done to the car I hit.
Mm-hmm.
The police let me go, didn't charge me, and didn't charge the lady I hit, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I went around, I turned around the corner and went one block, and he pulled me over. He had me do a breathalyzer.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't blow anything. Like, I didn't have, he wanted to catch me for impaired.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't get the reading he wanted, so he charged me with careless driving. But he let me go and drive a block, then he pulled me over again. That's the Durham system. And I was actually, I'm not lying, I was documented at the Whitby jail. I was beat up by the Durham cops in my own bedroom. Because I asked to go to the washroom. They're a bunch of cowboys. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
They are just a bunch of cowboys.
So you believe, I guess, like, you're one of the many people who is lost within, I guess, this kind of prison and police system where people are constantly harassed. Do you believe that you can, make links with some of the, I guess, common struggles that exist with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, the work that they do through our communities in Ontario.
They're making me poor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to lose my house because I can't get bail. I'm going to lose my job because I can't get bail. And they're letting people out that have past criminal records without wounding and assault and all kinds of stuff. But I'm a danger, they say.
So I guess the police repression that you feel or the police harassment perpetuates the level of poverty probably within the community of Whitby and within the many.
Once they get a hold of you, they always, as they say in the movie Casablanca, pick up the usual suspects.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just incredible. I never had any dealings with them. I didn't have a criminal record until I was 50. And I have spent about 135 days in jail last year. Just on stupid charges.
Mm-hmm.
Once they get you, they got you. They won't let go because it's a moneymaker for them.
Definitely, I guess. Even, like I think Sean was mentioning it earlier, the people who are, I guess, the true criminals in society, the blue-collar, not the blue-collar, but the corporate criminals who are causing great, great amounts of devastations, they're the ones who are always given slaps on the wrists, who are the crimes are always ignored, but in many cases...
Well, let's put it this way. They charge you with so many charges and hope you plead down just so you get out, eh?
Mm-hmm.
I took a stand this time and I just said, I will not plead guilty to anything because I'm not guilty. They charge you with six or seven, and then they get you in here and they won't give you bail, so you're going to lose your job, you're going to lose your house. And then they say, that's too bad. That's the way the system works.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was told. It was unfair, unjust, but that's the way it goes. Take it or like it. You know, plead guilty and you get out.
Do you believe, I guess, the policies of the Mike Harris government play a role in the amount of harassment and repression that you feel as an individual?
Well, of course I do. The system does that because there has to be have-nots and there has to be the winners. And the definition of history is the agreed-upon lie by the winners. And the winners are the ones who have control, and they write history.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can change it any way they want.
As we see, I guess, with the system of capitalism and the system of, just the way that the province of Ontario works nowadays, and it's worked in the past as well, we see the widening gap between...
Yes, there is. In the last, I've been working for 37 years. I was better off 30 years ago
mm-hmm.
than I am now. I am just barely getting by. And I won't be getting by because I won't have a job because I can't get bail.
Mm-hmm.
I know enough that I asked to go to a higher court, and they won't do that because it's only a JP, and they're paid by the government.
Mm-hmm. Working as part of, they're basically perpetuating a lot of the times that...
No, I should have been out
mm-hmm.
2 weeks ago, and they won't let you sign for yourself. They got to get an surety, and the thing is, I don't have any friends. I don't have any family. So they're discriminating against a person who basically lives by himself and goes to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't sign for myself. And I think Sean Lee's back, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for being with us.
Okay.
Hey, Stu.
Hi there. I guess I was wondering if you had any more thoughts before we... any closing thoughts that you'd like to leave with listeners who might be tuned in today?
I guess being in jail for me has really made it clear how relative freedom is in the world. That in lots of ways, sure, your freedom is denied in the most absolute way when you're in jail, but freedom's denied to different increments all over society, whether that's your freedom being denied because of lack of access, lack of action on accessibility issues, and you're in a wheelchair and there's no ramps where you are. It's freedom being denied because of racially based policing and it being more likely of you being stopped by cops because you're not white. If it's freedom being denied because of the area that you grow up in, the schools don't offer advanced courses, so you're not going to get a chance to go to university. I think there's all sorts of ways in society in which a freedom's denied, and being in here, it really, really makes that clear. So I think I'd leave people with that, and with the reminder that there are, they call it struggle for a reason. It's not because it's easy, but we're here because there's really no choice, and I would encourage people to get involved in the fall campaign, to get in touch with OCAP or in touch with organizations that you're part of, and encourage those organizations to endorse the campaign. But more importantly, to get involved in your own community. If you don't know people who've been to prison or who have friends or families or loved ones in jail, why is that? What do we need to do to push ourselves out of our sort of comfortable middle-class activist bubble and world, and working on our own issues, to start working on issues that are important to people in places that we live?
Okay, Sean, I'd like to thank you a lot for being with us tonight.
You're welcome, Stuart.
Thanks a lot.
Best of luck.
If you would like more information on the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty and the Fall Campaign of Economic Disruption, visit OCAP's website at www.ocap.ca.
That was Sean Lee Popham of OCAP. Thanks to Stuart Duncan for that tape. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. On July 6th, the press conference was held by OCAP and the Toronto Disaster Relief Committee to speak out against the illegal detention of OCAP activists John Clark and Sean Lee Popham, and the criminalization of dissent.